Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm John Milford, chair of the club's Grown-Ups Forum and your chair for today. We also welcome our listening audience and we invite everyone to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now it's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Susan Jacoby. An independent scholar whose work now focuses on American intellectual history, Susan Jacoby began her writing career as a reporter for the Washington Post. Jacoby has been a contributor for more than 25 years on topics including law, religion, medicine, aging, women's rights, political dissent in the Soviet Union, and Russian literature to a wide range of periodicals and newspapers. Her articles and essays have appeared in the New York Times Magazine, Washington Post Book World, Los Angeles Times Book Review, Newsday, Harper's, The Nation, Vogue, The American Prospect, Mother Jones, and the AARP Magazine, among other publications. They've been reprinted in numerous anthologies of columns and magazine articles. She is also the author of the weekly column, The Spirited Atheist, at the On Faith website published by the Washington Post. Susan Jacoby has been the recipient of many grants and awards from the Guggenheim, Rockefeller, and Ford Foundations, as well as the National Endowment for the Humanities. In 2001, 2002, she was named a fellow at the Center for Scholars and Writers at the New York Public Library. Never Say Die, The Myth and Marketing of the New Old Age is Susan Jacoby's 10th nonfiction book. Please welcome Susan Jacoby.
Yes, the Grown-Ups Forum. I try to be. Before I begin talking, can you see me, by the way? This is a very tall podium. I want to ask, just to get the sort of the feel of my audience, how many of you would like to live to 100? Just raise your hand. Okay, actually fewer than in most of my audiences. That's interesting. But I suspect in any case, those of you who raised your hands mean I'd like to live to be 100 if I have my mental capacities and reasonably good health and can live life as I've known it. There are time bombs in this room, however. One of them is standing right behind this podium, and a few of you are scattered throughout the audience. You all know that the oldest members of the baby boom generation are turning 65 this year, and many of you out there in your early 50s and 60s are right behind us. So here I am. I'm standing before you. I'm 65, as healthy and energetic as I've ever been in my life, except for a bad knee that's not really the result of my age, but of a very unglamorous fall over a lettuce leaf in my local vegetable store many years ago. So why do I call myself a time bomb? Because in 20 years, unless I die at a younger age than the rest of the women in my family, who generally live well into their 90s, I'm going to be leaving the relatively healthy country of what demographers call a young old, mainly people in their 60s and 70s, and entering the much harsher territory of the old old in their late 80s and 90s. In fact, there are going to be 8.5 million Americans over 85 by 2030, and our country is simply unprepared to deal with the social and economic consequences of such a large increase in the old population. Now, one reason I think we're unprepared is that Americans are not, shall we say, very good at long-term thinking. But the second and most important reason is that we really don't like to think, any of us, about what it means to live in the land of the old old. The baby boomers in particular seem to believe in some version of a fairy tale ending in which we're all going to die of a heart attack, never having had a sick day in our life before then, at the age of 95 while making love or skydiving or paragliding. The skydiving and paragliding centenarians are a very big staple of articles in the AARP magazine. Right now, there's a commercial all over the TV in the East for a financial advisory firm that boasts that it's managed to teach a woman how to save enough money to live richly until age 186. And the end of the commercial shows this putatively 186-year-old woman paragliding, of all things. I don't know whether they are envisaging that she is ever going to die, but the idea is that the financial advisory firm, even if you never die, will enable to advise you about how to have enough money to live forever. Now, this fairy tale bears about as much relationship to most real deaths in old age, which come usually after an extended period of physical or mental disability or both, as the earlier boomer fantasy of painless childbirth did to real labor. Now, here's part of what old age really means. More than half of us who do live long enough to blow out 85 candles on the cake will suffer from dementia, of which Alzheimer's is the leading cause. More than half of us will spend some time in a long-term care institution. Most of the old are women. And unless they were married to very rich men who left them a lot of money, women grow poorer as they age and are poorer than men for a variety of reasons we'll return to later. One of them being that most of the oldest survivors of are widows who no longer have a loving partner to care for them. My own grandmother, who died at 99, was a typical person in that she outlived her assets and had to depend on Medicaid in her final years. Indeed, it's a good thing she died in 1998 before there was a political movement to cut the deficit by depriving greedy geezers of entitlements to which they supposedly are no longer entitled. It costs more to live out your final years and to die when you don't have someone who loves you to do things for you without being paid. I hope none of you find that too blunt. I help care for my partner, who is just 15 years older than I am and who died of cancer mercifully before Alzheimer's took the last of what had been his brilliant mind. So I have a very personal idea of what it would mean for me to be in the same condition without a loving partner to care and help shoulder the burden. So what's wrong to be hoped to be in the healthier half of the older survivors? Nothing at all. And I'm sure everyone in this room, hope that if I do live into my late 80s and late 90s, I'll be like Betty White or Justice John Paul Stevens, who's writing brilliant essays after his retirement from the court at the age of 90 that we would all like to live at any age. So I have the same hopes that everybody else does. But hope isn't a plan of action. I decided to write this book when I attended a panel on aging several years ago at the World Science Festival in New York City. And the title was 90 is the New 50. Who could possibly believe that, I thought. And I went just to see who could possibly believe that. Well, when I arrived, there was a standing room only crowd. And the atmosphere was pretty much that of the revival meetings conducted by Sister Sharon in the old movie of Elmer Gantry, if any of you have seen that. I submit to you that 90 is not the new 50. It's not even the new 70. And 70 is not the new 50 either. And I don't think that these are harmless illusions, because they pose a serious obstacle to public discussion about what we need to do as individuals and as a society to make 90 a better 90 and 80 a better 80. When I was growing up in the 1950s, old age was generally viewed as a very dull and dreary time of life, something that began as soon as a man retired and returned home to bother his wife, whose only conceivable role was that of a babysitter for her grandchildren. And if the image of parents having sex was unnerving, the image of grandparents having sex when I was a teenager was absolutely unimaginable to me. Many of these attitudes began to change in the late 1960s for two reasons. First, Americans who were around 65 back then were influenced by and often participated in the dissident spirit of the times, which I'm happy to see some young people in the audience, and I'm sure you're sick of hearing about the glories of the 60s from members of the boomer generation. But plenty of grandparents of that era marched for civil rights and against the Vietnam War. Dr. Benjamin Spock, the emblematic older statesman of anti-war protest, had been born in 1903. These new social activists also coined the term ageism to describe discrimination against and negative stereotyping of the old. The second and most important factor in the emergence of gray power was, of course, increasing longevity. Now, the much-needed debunking of stereotypically negative images of old age, such as the ones I grew up on, represents the positive side of attitude change toward the old. But the flip side is this. It's considered just great to be old as long as you're, quote, aging successfully, which means that you must not exhibit or talk about the worst problems of advanced old age if you are really one old. Here's what one cannot do, I think, and be considered a person who is aging successfully. Complain about health problems to anyone younger. Weep openly for a friend or a lover who has been dead for more than a few months. Admit to depression or loneliness if you are alone. Or express nostalgia for the past, either personal or historical. American society also looks with a kind of suspicion on old people who demand to be let alone to deal with aging in their own way. And so one must look neither too needy for companionship nor too content with solitude to avoid being considered a discontented geezer or crone. Successful aging awards are conferred on those who have managed, and often as much by biological good luck as their own effort, to avoid or convince others they've avoided the arduous uphill fight that eventually consumes everyone who lives too long to live well. The reality evaded by propagandists for the new old age is that we are all capable of aging successfully until we aren't. There are three things we need to look at when we think about the future of the old in America. One is health, of course, both physical and mental. The other is economic class and money. Who's able, really able, to save enough for a decent standard of living into old age, and who isn't? And the third thing we need to look at is more elusive, whether you call it emotional satisfaction or happiness or wisdom, whatever you choose to call it, for those who are lucky enough to live into their 90s with intact minds. I believe that a realistic look at scenarios ranging from the ordinary to the worst case, because the Betty Whites and the John Paul Stevens can take care of themselves, but I believe a look at what happens to most people is necessary before we can begin to seriously talk about how to make life better, not only for rich 186-year-olds who are paragliding in TV commercials. And I'd like to point out that I'm using the word old deliberately, and it's considered an obscenity by much of the mass media, because I consider it an honorable description of a stage in life. That's all. The Today Show on the first Monday of 2011 kicked off the year with a story about boomers turning 65 in a segment titled, predictably, Forever Young. None of the experts on the panel used the three-letter word old, and I even looked at it again on the internet to make sure my prejudices weren't interfering with what my ears were hearing. The preferred euphemisms which they did use are older. Older than whom, I ask you, and aging. Now, aging is a particularly stupid euphemism for old, because while everyone in this room is aging, we are not all young. My nieces are in their 20s, and they are aging, and they are young. I am, well, do the math. 65 is certainly not middle-aged. How many 130-year-olds are out there walking around on the street right now? Another reason I wrote this book is that, as I've mentioned, I'm the daughter and granddaughter of long-lived women. My maternal grandmother lived to be 99 with a sharp mind and a ruined body. I'll never forget her saying to me on a day when I took her out of the nursing home for a picnic on a nearby riverbank, which also turned out to be the last day I saw her on this earth, that the worst thing about having lived to this age is to know that you are no longer of use to anyone. She did not say this bitterly at all, but with a clear-eyed vision of her life, which was no longer life as she had defined it. Not other people, but she herself. And she defined herself by her usefulness. My mother at 90 also has a sound mind in a body that now confines her largely to her room in an assisted living facility. When my last book was published just 3 years ago, my mom organized a reading for me at a bookstore in my hometown in Michigan. And believe me, if she'd organized all my readings, you'd be looking at someone who'd arrived here in a limo and whose sales were somewhere in the vicinity of Danielle Steele and James Patterson. This time around, however, my mother's not physically able even to sit through an event that lasts for an hour. She has lived too long to live well, but until 3 years ago, she was a perfect example of successful aging. I think that the much-needed debunking of the images of old age I grew up on have been accompanied by a new but no less pernicious form of ageism. American culture now exalts old people only if they're vigorous enough to shatter the stereotypes of the 1950s. And one of the things that this does is it downplays very real problems, like the frightening explosion of Alzheimer's cases, in the hope of a medical miracle. No one believes in science more than I do, but most of the scientists I interviewed for this book say, yes, indeed, medicine is going to come up with something to treat and delay, if not to cure Alzheimer's, but it's probably not going to be for those of us who are over 50 now. More likely for our children and grandchildren. This is not an argument, by the way, against scientific research. All the more reason why we need to invest more money in it now. I'm going to talk a bit more about Alzheimer's, although I know it's the last thing any of us like to think about, whatever age we are, because the way it's discussed in the media embodies the doublethink that surrounds most of the issues associated with an aging population. My own partner suffered from Alzheimer's for 5 years, and cancer took his life before he lost the last remnants of his mind. The media have long tried to disingenuously soothe people by saying that Alzheimer's is not a part of normal aging and that only 10% of people over 65 suffer from this truly horrible disease. The 10% figure is true, but what it leaves out is that the risk of Alzheimer's doubles in every five-year period over age 65. And among those over 85, the chances of dementia are 50-50. How can a disease that affects half of people in that age group not be age-related? The second piece of bad news is that none of the things that the boomers believe are going to help us defy old age. Exercise, a good diet, maintaining a healthy weight, not smoking, have been found to have any scientifically verifiable effect. Unfortunately, last August, the National Institutes of Health conducted a rigorous evaluation of all of these claims. It was front page news, and for those of you who still read newspapers all over the country. And the scientists had truly believed they would find encouraging results by taking a look at all of these studies. And they found no scientifically, good effect, something that scientists consider is more than a placebo. Now, no one was more upset than the scientists themselves. They expected to find good results. This is the difference between science and faith. Science has to look and see if experiments and results are replicated. It can't just say it's so because we believe it to be so. And I'm not saying that these aren't all great things that help keep us healthy at any age, but they're great because they help us now, whatever age we are. They help people of whatever age live better with diseases they already have, except degenerative genetic diseases, genetically based, like Alzheimer's. And I'm particularly outraged by those ads for memory-enhancing drugs. I know you've all seen them, which were also found to be basically worthless in the NIH review. You know the ones I'm talking about, the ones in which one daughter turns to the other and expresses her joy that Aricept has helped Dad be more like himself. They never show Dad taking his pill, walking out the door, getting lost, and being returned 7 hours later by the police. They never show my partner turning to me on the bus and haltingly searching for the words to describe his frustration. He said, "I feel it somewhere inside me is the person I really am, the person I used to be before, but I can't see him. I can't talk to him." What could be a more eloquent description, actually, showing that people know what is happening to them in the early stages of this disease? He would say, "I'm so stupid," as he turned the pages of a photo album of things we'd done together
because he couldn't remember where the pictures were taken. So what do you do if someone you love tells you something like this? If the doctor has prescribed a memory pill, a very expensive pill, I might add, even though you've read enough of the medical literature to know that it really has no effect, you give it to this person just in the hope that it will, you know, have a good placebo effect. And he took these pills docilely, but I'm sure that while he was still able to think things through, he had no faith in them. Once he said in Yiddish, after taking the pill on a beautiful summer day, Gornisha Helfen, which means in Yiddish loosely, beyond help, or nothing will help, or I'll take it, but it won't help. This had been the punchline of a number of ancient Jewish jokes he used to tell in the days when he could still tell jokes. Now, I tell my own story not because this experience, either my experience of helping to care for someone with Alzheimer's or his of knowing that his mind was dying, not because it's unusual, but because it is common. And this is the case not just with Alzheimer's, but with many of the experiences of old age, including the fact that the huge gap between the rich and the poor in America weighs even more heavily on the old than on the young. Sergeant Shriver died last month at home, surrounded by his family and with the best palliative care money can buy. But many of us who will be among the half who have dementia will die in nursing homes after our life savings are exhausted and Medicare is taken over. The gap between the rich and the poor, as is well known, has widened during the past 20 years. But all we're hearing right now from Washington and state governments, obviously California is as acutely aware of this as any other state, is the need to cut entitlements, chief among them Medicare, Social Security, and Medicaid. But what we're not hearing is any realistic talk about who is going to take care of Granny 20 years from now if we do cut these programs. Because I'm here to tell you that if we're not going to kill Granny, that odious term, you know, perpetrated by the political right, then we're going to have to support Granny, unless our idea of a good society is having old people living homeless on the streets. A lot of this talk is based on the implicit and explicit assumption that today's old are all affluent, greedy geezers, or as former Senator Alan Simpson of Wyoming, the co-chair of the Federal Deficit Commission, so eloquently put it, Social Security is a cow with 310 million tits. Well, I don't think that this misogynist metaphor was an accident, by the way. Fact is, two-thirds of people over 85 are women, and the older we get, the more they are women. What are the real facts about the economics of old age today? First, 75% of Americans over 65 have income from all sources, including Social Security, that does not exceed $34,000. This actually shocked me. That's the newest report from the Bureau of Labor Statistics. Does that sound like lavish living? I don't think so. Household income drops precipitously with every decade, mainly because most women, unless they were married to Warren Buffett, become automatically poorer when their husbands die. Now, it's been assumed that boomer women will be in a much better economic position than their mothers because we work more during our lifetimes outside our homes. And while that may be, we're still going to be much poorer than men 20 years from now, partly because the interrupted work history of working moms leads to lower pensions and lower Social Security at the end of life. Women don't work the same number of years typically that men do, and that makes women poorer in old age, even if they have worked more, as boomer women have. So it's certain that for many of us, old age is going to be a lot tougher financially than we anticipated. Most of the lamentation in the media, by the way, about the decline of the value of 401ks since what I'm sure is going to be known to history as the crash of 2008 is being done by and on behalf of the 50% of Americans prosperous enough to have made an income that enables them to contribute to those accounts and lucky enough to work for employers who also contribute, which half of Americans don't. Most waiters, retail sales clerks, receptionists, people whose jobs place them among the just getting by, don't make enough money to contribute to these accounts, even if their employers provided them. This was not the way we expected things to be. But in spite of the baby boom generation's need, and however well or poorly our economy recovers, There will surely be no setup in the substantial pressure for cuts in benefits. Both the size of the federal deficit and the long-term economic difficulties of young voters, including younger boomers in the wake of this crisis, are likely to make young working Americans much less quiescent about ever-increasing Social Security and Medicare deductions than my generation was. I don't think there is any one-generation solution to this problem. I'm not saying for a moment that we don't have to do a lot of thinking about how to spend money well, but this thinking has to be based not on fantasy. Proposals to raise the retirement age are a case in point. Now, I'm no fan of retirement, and I have no intention of retiring until the reading public retires me, which, of course, could always happen. I plan to go on writing for a living as long as my mind allows me to write and as long as there is a print publication left. However, let's talk about raising the retirement age to 70, which sounds so reasonable on the face of it. But what about people whose work has left them physically unable to go on that long? And I'm not talking about just about obvious hard labor jobs like coal mining or cleaning toilets in hotels for a living. Think about it, what it means to physically to make your living standing behind a counter for 8 to 10 hours a day in a store. This chair is for me so that I can baby my knee when I sit down during the question and answer period. Do checkout clerks in supermarkets have chairs where they can sit down when they're tired of standing? In my neighborhood grocery stores in New York, I see a lot of women my own age, most of them African American or Hispanic, working the cash registers when I'm buying food on my way home from a stint in a special room for nonfiction writers at the New York Public Library. Do they have the same capacity to go on standing into their feet into their 70s as I will to write sitting in an ergonomically designed chair before my computer? Do legislators in their 70s and 80s who have staffs to fetch and carry for them think about this when they talk about balancing the budget on the backs of the old? The truth is that healthy old age is expensive, and unhealthy old age is even more expensive. Now, here's where the danger of the delusion of 90 is the new 50 comes in. If that were really true, then everyone could take care of himself or herself, and there'd be no need for society to worry. We'd all be able to tote that barge and lift that veil until the very end. The final element is what I like to call the emotionally correct vision of the new old age, emotional correctness being the first cousin to political correctness. The so-called, it's a largely unexamined conviction that people grow wiser as they grow older. And this so-called wisdom of old age is supposed to trump every other difficulty. The only problem, as far as I'm concerned, is that there's about as much evidence of the wisdom of old age as there is of the medical efficacy of holy water from Lourdes. Now, don't misunderstand me. I'm not saying that there aren't a lot of wise old people. I'm saying that merely growing older doesn't magically make you wiser. If you're a person who learns from experience and learns from your mistake, you start doing that when you're a lot younger. You don't magically acquire the ability to learn from experience if you've been someone who never admits a mistake when you're in your 40s or 50s. All you have to do, I submit, is Exhibit A and B, and I'm sorry if there are admirers in this room. I'll be happy during question and answer to answer. I submit to you former Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld and former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger as prime examples, age 78 and 87. The chief quality of Rumsfeld's memoirs is that if any mistakes were made in the Iraq War, which he doesn't admit, actually, that they weren't his mistakes. He is what he always was, a responsibility-shifting bureaucrat wanting to take the credit when things go well and unwilling to take the blame when they go badly. And he hasn't become wiser, he's gotten older. He's just exactly who he was. The same thing with Kissinger's memoirs. He wrote in a memoir called Crisis, written when he was 82, and God help me, he's writing another memoir about China now. He wrote that someday we have to figure out why good and wise men allowed the extension of the war in Cambodia to take place. He was the chief instigator, as all of the historical documents show, of the extension of the war into Cambodia. What he doesn't consider is that maybe he wasn't all that wise in doing that. So a question I've been asked frequently at various appearances on this book tour, is how to reconcile my vision of old age with surveys that seem to show people grow happier as they grow older. The answer is that the media have mishandled those surveys as they mishandle so many things. And I know, I've been a member of the media for many years. Who knows better than a sinner who keeps trying to do better? What these surveys actually show, conducted by institutions ranging from the Bureau of the Census to the Gallup poll, is that people become happier in their late 50s, 60s, and 70s than they were in their 30s and 40s. And that actually makes sense to me, because you've resolved a lot of things if you lived a good life, a lot of conflicts of earlier life. But happiness in these polls begins to drop in the 80s again. And that, too, makes sense to me, because people in the 80s begin to experience these losses of which I have spoken. Furthermore, some of these polls, particularly the much-quoted Gallup poll last year, actually exclude people over 85. They don't consider it worth asking people over 85 how happy they are. They exclude everyone who lives in an institution, and of course they exclude everyone with dementia, because no one with advanced dementia can answer a question. I think it's shocking that in these happiness surveys of the old, that the biggest polling institution in America doesn't ask the question to people over 85. Now, part of this, and I'm winding up now, part of this is our real belief in the power of positive thinking. And we're told constantly that even if we can't control our objective circumstances, if we just think positively, we'll be happy. The AARP magazine, for which I used to write, I don't think after this book they'll be asking me to write for them too much, appeared last year an article called The Secrets of Resilient People. What defines people who are successful at handling the many losses of aging, asked the magazine. They view the glasses half full. I'm quoting now. They refine the silver lining. They, quote, actively seek solutions. Apparently the rest of us refuse to get out of bed in the morning. There is no hope here for anyone who sees a cloud as a cloud. They particularly tell the story of one Deborah Robinson, whose 57-year-old husband was diagnosed with early onset Alzheimer's in 2002. And she survived. She's presented as an example of a model of how to survive the progression of this disease. She decided to, quote, reframe the situation in the most positive terms possible. She decided that, quote, we would rise above it and it would be our finest hour, unquote. The article goes on to present a formula for positive change to those whose dark view of life, I can't imagine why, prevents them from thinking about Alzheimer's as an opportunity for personal growth. Experts say that negative thinking is just a bad habit, the article assures readers, though it may take some work to change your mindset. I'll say, I'm glad that nobody said to me when my partner was diagnosed with Alzheimer's, this is your opportunity for your finest hour. I would have been hard put to keep from hurting my hand, you know, with a well-timed punch. I also think there's something insidious about the equation of happiness and contentment, which is accompanied not by physical exhaustion in the oldest old. My mother had a knockout course of intravenous antibiotics this year to clear up an infection, and she had the temerity to complain about how tired she was to a visiting nurse. Why don't you just be good to yourself, dear, and lie in bed all day and watch TV, the nurse said. As it happens, staying in bed and watching TV all day is not my mother's idea of a meaningful, happiness-filled day. She's not contented, and I admire her for that. If I'm fortunate enough to retain the powers of my mind, and I only hope for that, I don't count on it, I want to remain a discontented work in progress as long as I live. I've asked myself repeatedly why I feel so strongly that the myth of the new old age is harmful not only to society but to individuals. People have made this argument. They've come up to me after talks and said that there's nothing more wrong with adults believing that age is just a number than children believing in Santa Claus. To this I reply that adults are not children. The old are not children, even though they're often treated as children. Hope isn't incompatible with realism, but it is incompatible with the expectation that things are going to turn out just fine if we just behave well. The great French writer Colette, who lived into her 80s, said at age 79, "We can never look enough. We can never look exactly enough. We can never look passionately enough." The myth of the new old age spreads a miasma that obscures that intensity of memory and vision that is the true gift of sentience if one is able to remain aware until the very end. It's impossible to look enough, to look exactly enough, to look passionately enough, while rejecting reality in favor of fantasies. On our last day together, my grandmother did not only mourn about her uselessness, as she put it. This poet with only an eighth grade education also said, taking a long look at the river, her last look at that river, "It's good to know that the beauty of the world will go on without me." If I can say that in full knowledge of my own rapidly approaching extinction, I will consider my life a success, even though I will have failed, as everybody ultimately does, to defy old age. Thank you. And now I'm going to sit down in my chair for the question and answer, as I mentioned.
Remind our listening audience, this is a program of the Commonwealth Club of California, and you're listening.
This is too close, isn't it?
Jacoby.
Thanks.
Susan?
Yes, sir.
I know there are questions, so who will be first? And we'll pass.
Oh, I forgot about your pass the mic. It's a small room.
People can hear me without the mic, but I will use it. I have a voice that carries. It seems that the irresistible force is meeting the immovable object, the dilemma. As we get older, we will require much more medical care, which today is extremely costly, and there are limited resources. So somewhere along the line, there will be some rationing, or as people like to say, who's going to decide whether grandma is going to live? And maybe there should be some form of Dr. Kevorkian or somebody at that nature where you can decide. I understand some people do decide when they want to go, they just stop eating. But how do you reconcile the fact of heavily increasing expenses? And, for example, I accumulate a little wax in my ear. It's very normal. Other people do it. And I was shocked, even though I didn't pay the bill, to find out that some woman of talented but lesser skilled than a physician, it took her 20 minutes, and they billed the insurance company $400. Now, that's just a slight example, but I would wonder what your viewpoint is on that.
I'm going to answer that question a little length, if you don't mind. I do have a chapter about this called Endings in my book, which I'll be signing back there at the end of Q&A. I think that you raise a very crucial point. And I think that there are a number of common sense things we can do right now before we even talk about health care rationing, because the problem really isn't the $400 bill for your earwax. A third of the Medicare budget is spent in the last year of life, and half of that is spent in the last month of life. People's answer to that is you never know what's the last year of life. That may be true, but you do know what the last month of life is. A lot of this is care that people don't even want. This is where individuals, when they're healthy and young, as most of the people of various ages in this room are, or you wouldn't be here on this lousy night listening to this depressing subject, everybody should have, according to what the laws of their state allow, not only a living will and advanced directives about what they do and don't want have done to them at the end of life, but that's not enough in most states. You must also appoint someone you trust, whether it's a friend or a child or a partner, to carry out your wishes. Now, for all of the talk about this, only 30% of Americans have living wills. I don't think people, because no one likes to think about death, I don't think people realize they always assume that their child will be able to act for them, and also that their child will magically somehow divine their wishes that they've never talked about. One of the stupidest, dumbest things that ever happened was the objection of the right to voluntary consultations talking about end-of-life care between healthy patients over 65 and their doctors, because doctors don't like to think about this any more than people do. If everybody were not discouraged from but encouraged to spell out their wishes, that would cut a lot of this useless last-month care right there, because a lot of people, I don't think adults are children, and I do think that by having a mechanism by which people can talk about this with professionals and then with their families, that a lot more people would write down their wishes, and hospitals would be prevented from putting somebody on a ventilator who wouldn't have wanted it, or putting somebody on a tube when you wanted it. Here is a good example. My father died of lung cancer when he was quite young, only 72, and he was, of course, his mind was perfectly healthy, and my mother was alive and able to help him. At that time, there was even less to be done for people with lung cancer than there is now, and he had one round of chemotherapy because he really wanted to live, and then he asked his doctor, is any more going to do any good? And his doctor said, no, Bob, it isn't. And my father said, well, I don't want any more treatment. I want to go home. I want to have enough pain medication. There were no hospices then. I want to have enough pain medication so that I won't be in pain. And this being early 1980s were still another era. The doctor prescribed him all the pain medication he wanted, instructed my mother not to call EMS if she discovered that he was no longer breathing, because my father did not want those things. But now, if you want that kind of an end, you must write it down. And particularly, there are younger people in this room. The fact is, a lot of us are not going to have partners, particularly women, if we should live to an old age. That's just the fact. We can't count on it. And more than my mom used to work until 3 years ago when her body fell apart as a volunteer in the critical care unit of a large hospital in Lansing, Michigan. And she would tell me stories. She said the worst thing was, she of course has had her living will and her health care proxies for 30 years. The worst thing was to see families fighting it out in the critical care lounge over what mom or dad would have wanted, when mom or dad could just have stopped all this if they'd written it down when they can still do so. First part of your question is people have to take more responsibility. Secondly, and I think, you know, that would cut medical bills unimaginably if more people just said, I don't want the full I want everything done only if there's some chance in the opinion of a medical professional that I can be returned to some kind of a normal life. That would cut the bill enormously. I think Oregon's and Washington's assisted suicide laws don't go far enough, because they don't allow people, you have to have this terminal, they don't help someone, for instance, diagnosed with Alzheimer's who says, I don't want to live through to the inevitable. It doesn't help them at all. But I have to say that education for people about expressing their own wishes early is a lot more feasible than suicide, even voluntary euthanasia. The number of people who actually do this, as shown by how few people have used Oregon's law in the last 10 years, is actually very small. You hear people talking all the time, and the younger they are, the more you hear them talking about this, by the way. Oh, just pack me off, throw me in the river if I can't walk anymore, or I don't want to live if I can't see anymore. And the truth is, as we know, see from people around us of all ages with all kinds of major disabilities, the will to live is very strong, and a lot of people manage to live very gratifying lives with disabilities that for a healthy 30-year-old might seem unimaginable. So I don't think we can count on people checking themselves out as a solution. I think what we need is more realism about what we can do about these things early on to make sure that the full forces of the medical system aren't in. And the third thing is this: there is no solution to this without an intergenerational solution. I was, and this is where the, whether you think well of the health care bill or not that was passed last year, but only people over 65, two-thirds were opposed to government-financed health care for anyone but themselves. That disgusts me. And if the boomers act the same way, which is I've got mine and you've got yours to get to the rest, younger people in America, then we are going to have a crisis and intergenerational warfare. Because when I was making ever-increasing Social Security payments in my 30s and 40s, I wasn't paying 15 to 20% of my after-tax income for health insurance, as I have been for the last 20 years. And if young people don't have access to decent health care at a reasonable cost, they are going to be less, not more willing to pay for the greater expenses of health care for people who are older. There is no solution to this without a solution for everyone. And the old people over 65, 60,000 members resigned from the AARP just because it supported some kind of government role for health care for the young in principle. While the majority of the old are not greedy geezers, some of them are, and I would say not even greedy, but just short-sighted. And the fact is, it's only people over 65 who do have access to government-paid health care. There's something very wrong about that. It's not as though, true, people get sicker as they get older, but when people are sick when they're young, they need health care just as badly as the oldest old person does. So that's too long an answer to your question, I know.
Hi, thank you for your talk and your wit. Besides AARP, are there other organizations fighting to, you know, save the Social Security, and which checks have not even gotten higher? They say the inflation hasn't gone up, so
yeah.
But that's not true because the cost of living keeps going up. And do you think that? I mean, some people, that's their only income, Social Security. Do you think it's going to be all right? And what do you think will happen with that? And who's working on that?
Well, there are a lot of organizations working on it. I hate to say it.
Since
unions are a dirty word now, one of the major supporters of Medicare and Social Security are unions. There are smaller organizations like the Gray Panthers, but they're quite small organizations. The mighty AARP is the only, and it is a powerful lobby. And I respect them, although I don't agree with some of their happy talk about old age, but I respect them because they are fighting the good fight. And I think that one of the things I think that's going to happen is the people who campaigned on we've got to cut entitlement reforms, when they find out that those entitled people are their own voters, and those are the same people who only opposed health care reform for the young because they were afraid it would somehow be paid for by a cut in their benefits, I think they are going to get less mouthy about Social Security when they realize that old people vote in a lot of numbers. But I don't think there's anybody now who's working on it in terms of really making the case that we have to have an intergenerational solution to this, which is what I really believe.
Like you, I write nonfiction books. Mine are all how-to books, and how-to books are always focused on best practices. And the only best practice I've extracted so far from your talk is a living will. Plus, you refuted a long list of best practices that people follow thinking it's going to help, like eating and diet and
but
exercise.
But they are good practices. They won't necessarily make you live forever.
Well, are there other, as a result of having researched this and written this, are there things you're going to do that most people are not going to do to prepare for this period?
No. Because I don't think, apart from the life I'm living now, all of the things that these studies that don't prevent Alzheimer's, they do make you have a better life, whether you're 60 or 70 or 80. I intend to go on working and writing every bit as long as I can, but I don't intend to be doing anything particularly different from what I'm doing now, because I'm doing all the things that they say, all of these things that you're talking about, that they say that you're supposed to do. What I don't believe is, I don't believe that these things, I think they will make people, for example, things that are treatable in old age, though eventually you'll die of them too. But diabetes, for instance, there have been many advances made in the treatment of diabetes, and good health practices greatly contribute to the better health of people who live longer with those chronic diseases. If you have bad health practices, you will die sooner and you will die in a much less healthy state. For example, not being obese is related to a lot of conditions. Eventually, if you have diabetes, you will have a bad time if you live to be 90. But if you adhere to those good health practices, I'm sorry if I left the implication that I don't think those have value. What they won't do is preserve you from diseases with complicated genetic causes like Alzheimer's. And they won't help you live better with Alzheimer's really either, because it's a chronic degenerative neurological process. But those best practices of health help you live a lot better with a lot of diseases that people have at a lot of ages, including in old age. But I can't imagine what I could do differently than what I'm doing now. Do I think that playing computer games, also that was another thing they included in the survey, is going to prevent me from getting Alzheimer's? No, I don't. If I were young, if I were, let's say, 30 years old, I would certainly try to save more money than I did when I was 30. Simply because we're going to need more money in addition to saving Social Security and, I believe, expanding it and providing more for home care and things that would keep people out of institutions, which are vastly more expensive than having a little bit of home care for people who are healthy but need some help at home. I would save more money if I could do it all differently today. Now what you start saving in your late 50s and 60s doesn't add up to too much. But I also really, really don't believe that it is possible. The median income for a family of four is $61,000 a year in the United States, meaning I know that half, but some people don't know what a median is. Half make less, half make more. But if you think about a family of four, let's say people in their late 40s who have kids of college age, here's another very serious question. Sometimes, many times for people on ordinary incomes, not people who are poor, but people who are really, you know, just staying in middle class, it's a choice between saving for your own retirement and helping your kids out with college. Now, here's a question. Do you really want a society in which the 45-year-old or 50-year-old parent says to the kid, sorry, I can't help you out with that law school tuition. I can't help you out with that. I've got to save for my long-term care. That is not a very healthy society. And I will say, in this respect, I am a pessimist. I think the only way for people on average incomes to save enough for their own retirement is to be forced to do so by taxation. Good example, again, I will use myself, and I'm not particularly profligate, and I chose a profession which, unless you hit the jackpot, doesn't make you rich. It is very true that if I had invested everything I contributed to Social Security in the stock market since I first began working when I was 16 years old, even with the crash of 2008, I would have a lot more money than I will have from Social Security when I start collecting it. But I wouldn't have saved it if I hadn't had to contribute it to Social Security. I think it's the rare person at age 25 or 30 who is thinking about saving for their retirement. I am not even sure that it's a great thing in somebody who is that young to be preoccupied with saving for their old age. I've talked to a lot of old people about it, and they have mixed views on it. But I'm not sure a society which thinks about, you know, how I'm going to pay for my bills when I'm 90, I'm not sure that that's the best use of resources. And I don't think it's just Americans. I have so many friends. I lived in Moscow for several years when I was in my 20s. And the best friends of American journalists there were European correspondents, because we were all quite isolated in the old Soviet era. So I'm in touch with all of those people I knew in my youth. And there's a big difference between them. We've had similar careers, journalism, scholarship, that sort of thing. But they're not worried at all about their old age, because they were taxed and forced to save for it much more than we were when they were younger. And I can remember, I have a good Norwegian friend who used to say, I wish I were an American so I didn't have to pay all these taxes. Now he doesn't have to worry about his old age. There's a social network in place. that is going to take care of him and provide him with home care if he needs it. I'm not saying, obviously, a social welfare system such as they have in Europe, it doesn't work with the American character, but there are surely some intermediate compromise, mediated solutions that are better than what we have now, which is just sort of let the chips fall where they may. And, you know, one of the great, great achievements of the American 20th century was the reduction of poverty in old age. And do we want in the next 20 years to see that great achievement undone? And the reason Social Security, modest as it was signed was even in an era when people lived to be 62. People had proved that they didn't save for their old age unless there was a program that helped them to do it.
Susan, we have time for one more question.
Okay.
I'm the lucky one.
Young, you're young.
I hope this is a good follow-up question to this gentleman's earlier question and your response. I am in my 30s, and I am not preoccupied with how I'm going to pay for my life in my 90s. I'm actually preoccupied with how I'm going to pay for my mom's life when she's in her 90s. And I'm actually here because I was one of my grandmother's caregivers when she was in her 90s. And one of the things that experience taught me was that you don't age alone. It's very much an experience that you go through with other people, particularly family members. And so my question to you is, again, as a follow-up to this gentleman's question, is in terms of how-tos and your dreams, what do you wish existed that doesn't exist today that could help generations, younger generations, take care of the elderly as they age?
Well, one of the most important things I wish existed is simply, as I'm sure most of the people in this room, including you know, Medicare does not pay for anything at home. Often the care of people who are old and sick requires more from than even the most loving family members can give. I mean, for example, when my grandmother took care of her mother, my great-grandmother, my grandmother did not work outside her home in her 60s. She was quite healthy, and she took care of her 90-year-old mother. My mother had a paying job in her 60s, as do many women today. And those jobs are often a requirement, you know, for the maintenance of their households. If there is no home care, the assumption that even with the best will that families can do it alone is wrong. But often what I found in Alzheimer's, we had money. My partner took a lot of his retirement money in health benefits rather than pension money, which at the time I thought was a mistake and turned out to be a godsend. Because although he had many people in his life, he had me, he had two adult daughters who were just wonderful, and even though they had children of their own and jobs of their own, were around all the time, still there were times when he reached the stage where he could not be left alone, which wasn't the case for most of the time. But when he had to have someone there so he wouldn't wander off and get lost and things like that, we had the money to bring in a health care aide to stay with him. I think that it is essential families really often want to help people, but there have to be some resources available to them at home so that you don't have to put someone in an institution before they have to be there because you don't have the money for home health care. I don't think most of us who are in our middle years of life cannot be at home all day to take care for an aging relative. And this, I think, will be a particular issue for my generation and for yours, too. My generation has had many fewer children than the generation which preceded us. There are fewer potential caretakers in families today of my generation than there were in my parents' and my grandparents' generation.
Right. Susan Jacoby, thank you for your insightful comments here today.
And I'm going to go back and sign books for anyone who wants me to.
Absolutely. So meet Susan in the back of the room. We also want to thank our audience here, as well as our listening audience. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 108th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.
Thank you. Great audience.
Thank you.